Back to Hellscale before nightfall.
I know. There is salubrious ground for a campsite a few miles away. Once there, we can relax and talk.
What's wrong with here?
I want to put some distance between us and the nose. I'm not sure of the range of the beetles, and I don't want them getting a premature peek at the six of you.
Why not?
Patience, Dix. All things come to those who wait.
Small tents, made of a lightweight fabric, were set up easily and quickly. The SecMen had established a defense perimeter, assembling four tripod-mounted spotlights and alarm wires around the campsite. One of the M249 machine guns was mounted at the rear end of the AMAC. Guards were stationed every 20 feet outside of the perimeter. By the time the sun began its slow descent, the area was bathed in a bright white light. Dinner had been sumptuous, which helped to offset some of their anxiety. First, potatoes fried in fat, then remarkably tender and juicy beefsteaks, followed by baked ears of corn. Dessert consisted of thick slices of apple pie, swimming in cream. Afterward, sated, they drank the delicious, genuine coffee. The repast relaxed them, the strong coffee notwithstanding.
Everything seems secure so far. If the sewer are around, they're not planning anything violent.
I thought Plains Indians didn't attack at night.
And I thought you minored in American Indian history.
Sociological groupings, genotypes, cultural linkages and linguistics, and the like. Not whether they preferred waging war when the sun was up or down.
It's true that Indians didn't attack at night a few hundred years ago, because dew would take the tension out of their hide and sinew bowstrings or dampen the powder in the pans of muzzleloaders. The warriors we saw carried automatic rifles. Well, they don't have to worry about keeping their strings or powder dry.
Thanks. I feel much better now that I cleared up.
As they nursed their coffee, Hellstrom waved them over to him.
Gather round, boys and girls. Time to come clean and to speak of many things.
Of ships and shoes and sealing wax and of cabbages and kings?
Sir, you are more correct than you could know. Contrary to the accepted dogma, the end didn't come as a nightmarish surprise to everyone. A select few had realized it was quite inevitable that the world would end in nuclear fire. And long before entire nations were bombed out of existence, this elite group, who were the most powerful men of their day, figured out a way to survive the apocalypse they were responsible for. They had the forethought, foresight, and wherewithal to prepare for the worst. Though this group may not have anticipated every repercussion from the new cost, such as Skydark followed by the Big Freeze, they were well aware that a Deathlands would take the place of the North American continent. As many as 50 years before the new cost, underground complexes were constructed under a program known as Continuity of Government, the ultimate insurance policy should Armageddon ever arrive. Many subterranean command posts were built, located in 10 different regions of the country. The most ambitious COG facility was codenamed the Anthill. It was a vast complex with underground sewage plants, railways, stores, theaters, and even sports arenas. Supplies of foodstuffs, weapons, and anything of value were stockpiled. Because of its size, the Anthill was built inside of Mount Rushmore, using tunneling and digging machines. The entire mountain was honeycombed with interconnected levels, passageways, and chambers. The interior walls were reinforced with a special silicon foam mixed with molten lead to provide shielding against radiation. When the first bombs arrived, on the 20th of January 2001, the Mount Rushmore facility had been in operation for some 2 months. At that time, it was protected only by a skeleton force of soldiers. A group of scientists had taken up more or less permanent residence, sharing the complex with a few paranoid politicians and their families. The world blew out on noon of that day. The safety measures kicked in, and everyone inside was safe and sound. Or so they thought. Despite all their precautions, radiation and fallout storms still reached them. The Earthshaker bombs caused extensive damage to the anthill. Still, they had no choice but to remain in the facility in order to survive and, hopefully, one day govern again. It took them a while to realize that they were just as much victims of the nuke cost as those whom they referred to as the useless eaters of the world. When this select few, this powerful elite, did realize it, they were upset. It wasn't part of their program. They had assumed that after 10 years or so of waiting safely inside the anthill, all the world would be theirs to rule. However, the nuclear winter changed their plans, as did slow death from rad poisoning. Even if they managed to outlast the big freeze, they couldn't cure radiation sickness. So they embarked on a radical and daring plan. Cybernetic technology had taken great leaps since the era of prosthetic limbs and artificial hearts, and that self-same technology existed inside Mount Rushmore. Operations were performed on everyone living in the anthill, making use of the advances and techniques in organ transplants and medical technology. The select few within the bosom of the mountain, over a period of several years, were turned into cyborgs, a hybridization of human and machine. Of course, such transformations didn't solve all of their survival problems, nor were they intended to do so. Compensation for the natural aging process of some organs was very difficult to arrange. The anthill inhabitants needed a supply of fresh organs, preferably the organs of people who had died young, with their bodies in generally good condition. Because of the nuke cost, this supply was severely limited. So they came up with the next best solution, cryogenics, or a variation thereof. The temperature inside the facility was lowered just enough to preserve the tissues. Not to such a low degree that the organs were damaged, but low enough to suspend the aging process. Combined with their cybernetic implants, the people in the anthill achieved a kind of immortality. But they had only halted Father Death, not defeated him. They've spent over a century in their little frigid world, looking out over the wasteland, prisoners of their own fantasies of power.
So, who told you this fascinating history lesson, Hellstrom?
The before time pigs themselves oinked their tale to me. Over a period of a few years, I filled in some of the gaps myself.
So you're speculating?
Surmising. As a Freezy yourself, you should know what is possible.
I do. And I'm more than just a Freezy. I was a doctor of cryonics, and I know that for it to be effective, the subjects have to be deep frozen in liquid nitrogen at minus 196 degrees Celsius.
They found a way around that.
They. You keep saying they. Don't freezes have names?
Not as far as I've been able to learn. The only individual who has ever identified himself is a man calling himself the Commander.
How many times have you been inside the anthill?
Never. All of my communications have been conducted through the Beatles, which they use as surveillance and early warning devices.
How'd you arrange a trade agreement with them, then?
A simple question of supply and demand. They demand certain products, and I supply them. I learned that from my father.
Your father?
Baron Gustav Hellstrom. You and I are very much alike in background, Cawdor. Like you, I was the privileged son, the heir to a barony in the northeast. When I was 15, it was wiped out by a combined army of muties and forest people. I was one of the few survivors. I had received what used to be called a classical education, and though I was exceptionally book-smart and knew the pre-dark history of the Americas, I had little first-hand knowledge of how to survive Deathlands.
It appears you managed, and very well, too.
If you had met me only 4 years ago, you wouldn't have said that. For a long time I wandered and walked,